yesterday, Sunday, the June 4th, the Warriors for Freedom free speech rally occurred downtown at Cherry Shrunk Plaza. This rally occurred under an even darker cloud than it would have otherwise, on the heels of the Max Train murders Memorial Day weekend involving Jeremy Joseph Christian, a known neo-Nazi-minded right-wing guy who had had previous run-ins with the police and was known to be very agitated and violent towards left and liberal protesters who were often counter-protesting some of these other free speech rallies. I had an opportunity to talk with Old Mole Jan Hocken, who did attend the rally, but her insights in terms of psychology and mental health are what's important here for us in terms of how we understand the impulses behind right-wing white supremacist attitudes and violent actions as they do relate to questions of mental health. And we'll go to that interview now.
Jan, Friday before Memorial Day weekend, the city of Portland was hit with a really horrible event that occurred on the Max trains, where three men who had intervened in a situation where Jeremy Joseph Christian, now arrested for their murder, intervened to protect two young women who were on the other end of his racist and xenophobic diatribe. Jeremy Joseph Christian was arrested. He's not an unknown entity in Portland for activists and for police both. Through reading, we discovered that he was understood to have mental health issues. He was showing up at a number of events, particularly the event sponsored by right-wing and Trump-supporting groups, the Free Speech rally that they had. He showed up to that event carrying a baseball bat, which was removed by the police. And the police were quoted as saying, you know, this is a man who we believe had had a head trauma, a head injury, and mentally ill. So the narrative surrounding Jeremy Joseph Christian, of course, is about his mental health. And you, as a mental health professional for so long, both in the clinical setting and teaching at Portland State, and you're also an activist, you have plenty of thoughts about how these narratives play out, how they interact with the political landscape, and also what impact these sorts of things have on activists in their lives.
Well, often when a psychiatric diagnosis, or what's more euphemistically called mental health issues, which of course we all have to one degree or another, but that's meant to be less stigmatizing.
Right. And there's a lot to be crazy about right now.
Right. Yeah. So we all have mental health issues, including many of the people who run this country. The question of whether a psychiatric diagnosis is a useful way of understanding the situation is, I mean, it depends on how it's introduced. On one level, bringing in a psychiatric diagnosis or understanding someone who does terrible things as having mental health issues is a way of arguing against a kind of willful badness. And often mental health interpretations have been associated with a more progressive outlook, that people often do things for reasons not under their own control, and they're driven by tormenting voices. And the point that is often used in the criminal justice system, that people just willfully disobey the governing rules of society, it is a false notion of self-determination. So on the one hand, there is something always important to see people caught in these dramas, even when they do bad things or destructive things or harmful things, as in a way acting out some of their own internal torment. And I suspect that was the case here, that this was probably someone who may have been struggling with tormenting voices. The general psychiatric explanation, if he was psychotic and paranoid, would be it's a way of finding a target, an external target, for something unbearable, the unbearable noise in your own head. And sometimes that is part of a very self-destructive pattern of attacking yourself, stabbing yourself. There are many people who suffer from a psychotic disorder who harm themselves much more than others, but occasionally you know, sometimes this gets acted out where groups that are identified as the threat become the target. Now, it's also important to recognize, though, that conservatives are very interested in dusting off the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, you know, the Manual of Disorders, when it suits their purpose. And that rather than providing services for homeless people, helping people who are very fragile emotionally, who are burdened by tortured voices and have psyches that are very vulnerable to a lot of noise. And there are many people on the streets who do suffer from feeling like they're falling apart and their lives are falling apart. So rather than help those people, the attribution of a psychiatric disorder or mental health issues often is invoked to individualize the behavior, that this is just one crazy person. And similarly with the Orlando shooting massacre a year ago this month, where 40-some people were murdered and 50 people wounded by someone who came into a Latin gay club and massacred people. And so there was all this discussion, is this guy mentally ill? And yes, of course, but then the question is, well, how is the larger society implicated in this madness? What other madness is on the stage here? Here we have murder of these men who rose to protect these two women being harassed by this guy. On the Max line, it was a heroic act rather than passive bystanders or people turning away. These were men who stepped in and did try to de-escalate the situation. This also, by the way, is a pretty unusual situation. And there are so many cases where someone is crazy or attacking people and others step in to de-escalate, to protect the victims, which is what you do. You pull back and you move toward protecting whoever's being victimized and try to speak calmly and appeal or connect with the humanity of the person. And so one risk of a situation like this is people become afraid of intervening. Actually, these men did a very good job, from what I can tell, of trying to de-escalate the situation. But there were other things going on with this guy that were apparently very difficult to control.
And as I said, he was more a known entity to activists in Portland who had been in counter-protests to many of the gatherings that have taken place around the city, in which right-wing, fascist-oriented groups are coming together to protest and be public in their own right. In what way are these groups accountable? Because it is always easy to characterize that person as the lone wolf or just the crazy mm-hmm. person. We're not like that.
So we might use this frequently invoked notion of the bystander, that we all have a moral obligation to intervene, to step in, and it's become common wisdom. But it's not always so clear how and what that means. And there are a couple points, I think, that are important in relation to this issue you raised. It makes me uncomfortable when progressives argue, because he was known to the police, because he was known to be a troublemaker, something should have been done about this guy earlier. He should have been arrested. He should have been identified as dangerous. There actually has been a movement within the mental health field since the 60s that make it harder to arrest someone who's menacing unless they've done something. In our worry about people like this, we shouldn't sacrifice the restrictions on putting someone on a psychiatric hold, arresting someone on a mental health evaluation because you think they are bothering people because they're loud. And once someone has crossed that and actually threatened someone, it's a different issue. But I think we do have to be careful about what we call for. Like, who do we call a terrorist? And domestic terrorism, or calling on the police should have done something. Well, maybe not. That can also have enormous consequences, relying on the police or the FBI to do that kind of work.
Because the police have done things in the past in fact, killing multiple people in the city who are having mental health issues and around the country.
Right. And people being seen as psychiatric unstable, who are activists. So these are hard-fought rights to restrict what you can do when someone's behavior is upsetting you. There was a period of time, if someone in your family, their behavior upset you, if it was especially a woman or a child, you could have them hospitalized against their will and for very long periods of time. But the other, I think the other issue you're raising is more one of how do we think about a good society that equips people to intervene in certain situations, but also what sets people off who are vulnerable to this kind of threat and feeling the world is closing in on them. And one worry, of course, with the Trump administration and all of this rhetoric and more of a kind of muscular hard right taking over many communities or trying to find their legitimacy, especially in small towns. I mean, here in Portland today, that they're not a dominant force, but they're a scary presence in many rural communities. And people who are vulnerable to the ambient noise in the world around them can act this stuff out. And people who are paranoid, is interesting, in the 1950s, the most common delusional system for someone diagnosed paranoid schizophrenic was that the CIA was controlling their thoughts as a way of trying to get at the communists. And there was a preoccupation with communists and the CIA implanting things in their brain, thinking they're, you know, there was a lot about the Red Scare mm-hmm. was really central to delusional systems. And now there's much more of this theme of Arabs, I think especially Arab Americans, Muslims, mm-hmm. start becoming the focus of this kind of ambient fear. I think we have responsibility to kind of quiet the noise on our side too. How do you speak back to that mm-hmm. in a way that also is more thoughtful and doesn't just contribute to allow a lot of loud noise of they're evil, we're good, they're evil, we're good, which is also a characteristic of people with, quote, mental health issues, dividing the world into very simple, righteous, wicked distinctions. The counter demonstration was at Chapman Park, which was right by Terry Schrunk Plaza, but it was the area where the Occupy movement was centrally based, and it kind of evoked the memory and spirit of that. And I think many people down there were part of that Occupy movement, and today, again, it was for the afternoon, but there was this sense of reclaiming public space, that these men were murdered in public train, the MAX line, and someone from the Amalgamated Transit Union was there. That's where other representatives of other labor unions talking about these are public goods, our parks, our mm-hmm. trains, our buses, mm-hmm. and that we cannot be afraid to ride on our buses and trains, and that belongs to all of us. So the sense of understanding the symbolism that these reactionaries do pick public spaces because those are places where people gather, and often places of diversity, like the Orlando massacre was at a gay club. And these are represent places where people come together to have pleasure, to have enjoyment, to have picnics, to dance, to have fun. And if you attack those places where people of diverse backgrounds gather, you've really attacked something vital symbolically. So we have to also reclaim those places symbolically and in actuality.
Well, thank you, Jan, for joining me. For The Old Mole, this is Denise Morris and Jan Hawkins.